This is Redefining the Counterculture on Witten Radio. Make sure to check out our website at wittenradio.com.
Monster Energy, welcome to Rockville returns to Metropolitan Park, April 29th and 30th, celebrating rock's greatest hits all weekend long with Def Leppard, Soundgarden, A Perfect Circle, The Offspring, and more. 2 days, over 40 bands on 3 stages. Tickets on sale now. Go to WelcomeToRockvilleFestival.com for tickets, info, and more. Welcome to Rockville, fueled by Monster Energy Drink.
Hey guys, you're listening to another episode of Redefining the Counterculture right here on Witten Radio. Today we've got a special guest for you. We're joined by filmmaker Richard Bond. Richard is speaking about his newest film, Tupac Assassination, The Battle for Compton. Richard, how are you?
Great, thanks. Thank you for calling.
Oh, you're welcome. You're welcome. I'm super excited to talk to you about your newest film. One of your films. You've got quite the resume to you. I wanted to ask you, when did you first become involved, I guess, or interested in filmmaking?
Well, filmmaking has kind of always been around me peripherally. I grew up in the west end of the San Fernando Valley, and that's where a lot of people that work in the entertainment business, film and TV, where they actually live. They work in L.A. and Hollywood, but then they live in the what's called the San Fernando Valley. And I was fortunate enough to grow up with kids in school of people that were in the industry, and so it's always just kind of been around peripherally, and it was something I wanted to do. I got into doing work in motion pictures in the mid-90s, and I think that's kind of where I got the bug. I did a lot of off-camera work editorially, and then I did some work on camera. I worked on movies like Titanic and Volcano. I worked on movies, big movies in the 90s. And had a great time to work with some good filmmakers. And that just kind of led me more into wanting to do my own kind of, you know, low-budget production stuff. And I did a little bit of that, tinkered around with it. And the documentary bug kind of hit me, and I've been in documentaries ever since.
Man, that's awesome. That is awesome. I wanted to ask you, I guess, what aspect of filmmaking do you like the most? I know that you've done so much. You've done, a lot. You've worn many hats. Is there a particular job that you like more than, say, the others?
Well, the vain side of me loves to be in front of the camera and get your picture taken. I don't think there's anything more fun than that, right? But you know, truthfully, I think that the thing that's closest to my heart is the editorial side of it, working in editing, actually doing the physical editing of a picture, because I feel like it gives – they always call an editor the second director. And it really it's true, because a director can tell you how he wants to put the piece together, but, you know, in the editing room, a movie takes a life on of its own. And so it becomes much more of an exercise of another or a second creative vision. It's great if you're both the director and the editor, because then, you know, you've got unified purpose. But even as an editor, and I've worked on other people's projects before, as an editor, you can bring your own insight, and you really have a great opportunity to still sculpt the film to a vision that you hope that people will enjoy.
Absolutely. How would you say that the film industry has changed? I mean, you've been involved in it for quite some time now, and obviously with, you know, technological advances, you know, as well as, you know, cultural, I guess, advances, the industry has changed quite a bit, but you yourself, being so immersed in it, how would you say it's changed, and would you say that it's changed for the better?
Well, I think that there's a lot of different models that have changed that have affected the industry. I think one of the biggest things that's affected the industry is the proliferation of cable TV channels, Netflix, Hulu, you know, the non-broadcast, non-cable production outlets. And what that does is that creates this huge need for content. And that was really the big, you know, the big bottleneck. I remember even when I put out Tupac Assassination, first one, Conspiracy or Revenge, back in 2007, you really only had 2 swim lanes that you could be in from a distribution standpoint. One was you You got to go on broadcast TV, and you were a broadcaster on cable. Maybe a cable channel might pick you up. Or you went to brick-and-mortar DVD. That was really your only two choices. That's what you had. And, you know, and so it really became, if you were brick-and-mortar, the pain point that you had, for example, with our movie was that when we got into Target bought a bunch of copies of the movie, and everybody complained that they couldn't find it. And that was because Target was taking our documentary, and they considered it a music documentary, so they put it in the music section rather than the movie section. So people were, you know, calling up all the time, hey, I'm at Target. You said it was available at Target. We can't find it. And that was one big part. The second big part about brick and mortar was that when you know, Walmart might buy 50,000 copies of your movie, but it's where they put it, and they pick what stores they put it in. And so it becomes a real struggle to get media content to the people who want to see it. You'll have somebody in, you know, this is back in the day, you have somebody in, let's say, Champaign, Illinois, middle Illinois, who really wants a copy of your movie. And back in those days, there wasn't an Amazon.com to go to and you know, buy the movie. You really had to go to Walmart. But if Walmart decided, and it was really the merchandisers, Anderson, who made the decision on where your movie got placed, literally at what stores, if the Champaign, Illinois Walmart didn't carry your movie, that guy was just really out of luck. And so it made it very difficult to get your movie in front of the people that wanted to see it. Now, today, it's a completely opposite market where if somebody really wants to see your movie, my gosh, there's, you know, 100 different ways they can see your movie now. And so I think to answer your question about how the industry changed, I think that's really the biggest way that the industry has changed. You know, you look at shows like Westworld on HBO, or even movies that are on that are, you know, special to Netflix, or a series that's just literally to Amazon Prime. You know, you see a series that was made specifically for that network, and you've completely removed it from the entire cable industry, from the broadcast industry altogether. So now the challenge becomes we have all these channels and all these people that want content. But the problem with that is that there is only so much money to go around. So Absolutely. Even though you have a lot more of a demand for content, the people that are willing to buy your content can't spend as much because their sources of income of where they get money to pay for yours is stretched a lot more. And, I mean, it's kind of a double-edged sword. People don't think of it that way, but it's really true. You know, you get a Hulu or an Amazon, somebody who relies on sponsor ads, banner ads, things like that. Even YouTube, you heard about the crash on YouTube. That was a big thing where YouTube lost all of its, or not all of its, but a majority of its big, you know, big advertisers. Well, suddenly that money to buy content isn't there anymore. So if you really want to have something that is a YouTube or a Netflix, you know, show, you know, they're not going to pay as much for your show as they may have at one time. So the industry is kind of, you know, in a big kind of turmoil right now. It's kind of turbulent, but it's an exciting time for content providers, like people that make movies, because there's no shortage of places that you can get your movie out to. And that's really, I think, the biggest thing that's changed for the good. I really do.
Absolutely. Yeah, I'm inclined to agree as well. Regarding the state of film, where do you see, I guess, movie theaters heading within the next 10 to 15 years? Because I know, like you said, you know, the landscape is definitely changing. Digital content and, you know, the way that we view films digitally now has changed, you know, for the better with Netflix and, you know, streaming services and so on and so forth. And even, you know, direct to video has changed because you can basically download a movie, pay for it and download it and watch it in the comfort of your own home. Do you think that theaters will slowly go the way of the buffalo, or do you think they'll stay around but just change a bit?
I think that it's funny. I did a lot of work with a company called Cinedigm, and they're actually responsible for converting, I think, 80% of the theaters that are out there into the digital projection world where they're actually, you know, digitally projecting films now, rather than the old film format. And we have these kinds of discussions, so it's a great question. I think that the consensus among the industry entertainment people right now is that you know, film is still, going to the movies is still the cheapest form of entertainment you're going to get for new content, you know, in the broad spectrum. I want to go out and I want to go on a date. You know, it's $200, $300 if you want to go see a play that's worth its salt. You know, if you want to go to a concert, you know, $75, $80 a head for, you know, cheap seats at a concert. You know, whereas you can go and you can spend $15 a ticket for a movie, Guardians of the Galaxy, or some big spectacle movie, you can go in there and you may, you know, end up spending $60, $80 by the time the night's over for popcorn and sodas and all that. But at the end of the day, that's the limit of your investment. So it's really still the cheapest form of entertainment in terms of getting out and doing something, going out and seeking entertainment. So, and I think there's always going to be that need. I mean, teenagers have to have something to do, right? You got to have movies to go to. They have to have something to do. So I don't ever see that going away. But I do see that, you know, they're still screwing around with the, you know, IMAX and the 3D, and they're still screwing around with different, what they call immersive experiences, where they're trying to make the movie theaters more of an event where you're engaged, completely surrounded in the picture itself. And that differentiates it a lot from the home experience, where if you're watching a movie at home, you know, the telephone can ring or your kid can, you know, break something and down the hallway or start yelling about it. You know, there's a lot of distractions, a lot of things that you can't emulate that in a movie theater. You get that, you know, that complete immersion while you're just undivided attention. And so they continue to sell that immersive experience. So for that reason, those two reasons of the immersive experience and the budget, I think those are two reasons why theaters aren't going to go away. Now, I do know that they're experimenting right now with a lot of formats that are really shortening the amount of time between when a movie is released at the theaters and when it's, you know, actually at on TV or on, you know, some form of other delivery like home or, you know, pay-per-view or downloads. They're trying to shorten that window, and they're getting a lot of pushback from the movie industry on that because the exhibitors, the movie theaters, you know, they don't want to compete with the home download. You take a movie, there's several of them come out. I can't think of one by name right this minute, but there are actually several of them that have been released on what they call a platform release, which means they actually go to the theater and they go on your TV at the same time. They release in both places at once.
Wow.
And that's usually for a movie where it's kind of agreed between the exhibitors and the distributors that the movie's not going to do fantastic. It'll probably spend a week and a half at the box office, and that'll pretty much be the end of it. It's kind of your, I won't say B movie, but yeah, I would say your, you know, A-, B-plus movie, and maybe a smaller budget picture that really can't afford the rental or can't afford the digital fees for the movie theaters. And the movie theaters, you know, they'll book it for a while just when it's initially interesting, but they will release on, you know, pay-per-view at the same time. There's been a few like that I've seen. They're messing around with, you know, day one cable downloads where, you know, you can go see Guardians of the Galaxy the day it's released at the box office. But the pay-per-view on those are kind of what you pay for a middleweight fight on HBO, you know, when they do pay-per-view
right.
You know, it's $50 for the pay-per-view because they figure, well, we're getting the same box office that you pay if you went to the movie theater. So you're going to pay $38 to watch Guardians of the Galaxy in your home. And, you know, for a certain group of people, that's nice. I still like to go out with my wife and take Friday night being date night and go to the show. It gets us out of the house because it's something a different venue. And, you know, we go enjoy our movies like that. So I see them messing around with it, but I still think there's a good place for the movie theaters. And of course, it's up to the exhibitors to understand that and decide how badly they're going to screw up that opportunity.
Absolutely. You're so right.
Yep.
You're so right.
Yep.
I want to jump ahead, and I want to talk to you a little bit about your movie, or I should say your series of movies regarding the Tupac Shakur assassination. This is, you know, the subject of Tupac Shakur, you know, he's still, to this day, a very, you know, a very enigmatic, I can't, oh my gosh, I'm
enigmatic,
talking about
yeah, right.
Yes, person, and he, you know, a lot of people still struggle to really you know, understand him as a person and as an artist, even to this day. The subject regarding his murder is still, you know, very controversial. What made you decide to, I guess, look into this topic, and what was it that really drew you in about his life's story and particularly his death?
Well, I wasn't interested in it at first at all. To tell you the truth, I really wasn't interested in the subject matter at all. I wasn't a Tupac Shakur fan. I didn't know much about him because I wasn't much into rap music. I was more of a kind of metal, kind of, 70s band, kind of old school music lover. And so I wasn't too much into him. And, you know, at that time, I was still kind of leaning really right-wing, Dan Quayle, you know, George Bush type of thing. I was in the service. There was a lot of stuff that was kind of anti-Tupac and what he represented, according to mainstream media. You know, he was everything that was wrong with America at that point, right? And
right.
So I really wasn't interested in it. And it took my friendship with a man by the name of Frank Alexander. Frank was Tupac Shakur's bodyguard from about 2 years prior to his death until the day he died. And Frank and I met at an Orange County Fair through a third party. We became very good friends on our own. And it was just, for me, an interesting trivia thing. Tupac was dead by the time that I had met Frank. But it became a very interesting thing that he had done this and become Tupac's bodyguard. And while we stayed friends, we had kind of different paths we went down. Frank continued to do his bodyguarding and do his work. And I was producing an independent feature film at that point and was working on that. And so when Frank started talking to me about a DVD that he had done about his relationship with Tupac, that was really the time that I started to actually get to know who Tupac Shakur was through Frank, you know, how Frank looked at him, and get to know him and get to know what was happening with the record label and a lot of background information about it. Frank had put out a DVD himself and a book about the subject matter, and they had done well. Both of them had done very well financially. And so, you know, there's nothing wrong with a subject matter that you're interested in that could also be lucrative. You know, you don't get too many opportunities like that. So especially with the documentary. And so it became kind of one of those things where we looked at it. Frank said, hey, you know, I'm thinking about adding some more things to the documentary that I had already put out. And my advice to him was, well, why don't we do something different with that stuff? Why don't we, you've got some interviews and that, why don't we do something different with it? Why don't we take a look at things, you know, maybe how the record industry has changed over the last 20 years. You know, maybe we could look at it that way and use some of the footage that you've done, you know, in some other way. And that's what we did. So it really turned my head at that point. I was done with my, you know, my project. That was done and out. And from there, we just kind of started focusing on the area of Tupac. And that's, for me, when I get involved with a project, I pretty much have to know everything there is to know about it. And so I really started trying to do all the research I could on the subject matter. And, you know, I had Frank right there, so how much better can you get as far as, you know, reference material? And we moved forward on the first movie. The movie changed. It started as a look at how the music industry had changed. And then over the course of time, once we interviewed so many people, we kept asking them, you know, if the Las Vegas police ever talked to you about any of this. You know, they all knew all this information about what was happening around the time of Tupac's death and his shooting and what might have been involved. And there was a lot of interesting theories that were, you know, kind of floating around the inner circle. And I asked them all, you know, if Vegas police ever talked to you about this, and not a single one of them had ever, you know, Vegas police never talked to us. So
wow.
I think one day I just looked at Frank and I said, you know, this is our story, Frank. Our story's not that. This is our story. I mean, you've got all these people that could provide material information to the investigation of this murder, yet none of them have been talked to. Why not? And that, so that, to me, that became the much more interesting story. And that hooked me, and from there, you know, we took off and running, and kind of things haven't changed since.
Absolutely. Would you say that it was particularly arduous gathering the large amount of material that you guys procured in order to, you know, to create this documentary and the documentary before?
Yeah, it was extremely painful. You have to realize that we're, especially for the first one was easily the hardest. Whenever you're going into an investigation, if you're not a cop or you're not on the investigation team, you know, you're kind of got that blue wall that says, well, this is an ongoing investigation. We're not going to comment on this. We're not going to do an interview with you. We're not going to tell you anything, you know, about what we're working on because this is a closed, it's an investigation. We're not going to tell you. And that became difficult. The second thing that became difficult was a problem that plagued the entire investigation, and that was just people didn't want to talk. You would find people that would be willing to talk to you off camera all day long. The minute you wanted to ask them to go on camera with something, suddenly they'd rather be five other places. And then when you didn't get that, what you got was people that are willing to go on camera, you'd get them on camera and they'd start to talk and you'd ask them the same question you'd asked them before and they'd give you a 180-degree different answer. And that was the part that did just, you know, you're all excited to fire it up and you put together a whole team, a crew to, you know, film this person and you're excited because, you know, you've done the pre-interview, you understand what they're going to say. You know how it's going to fit in there, and man, this is going to be fantastic. We're going to get this guy to say it. And you ask the guy the $64,000 question, and he suddenly rolls over on you and says, I don't even know what you're talking about. And you have all these guys sitting around scratching their heads. What the heck? Wait a minute.
Yeah.
You could ask them again. No, I don't know. I don't even know what you're talking about, man. Well, wait a minute. Didn't you say? I don't even know. One of the funniest bits of video that I have was we actually literally caught that live. Like when they say that you catch a lightning in a bottle. We, on video, caught one of the bodyguards actually waffling on a statement that he had made to Frank. Now, when you make something to a filmmaker or somebody you don't know and people waffle about it, there's really not a lot of accountability there. You know, you just take it for what it is. But in this particular case, because Frank had been good friends with this other bodyguard, and this bodyguard had told him this time and time again, the story. So when we finally came time to ask this bodyguard about the story that he had told Frank and that Frank was all excited about him telling, we asked him the story. He played dumb, turtled up. Exactly. We didn't know. He didn't even have any idea what we were talking about. And Frank finally had to look at him, and they were both on camera at the same time. That's what made it so valuable. Frank looks over at this guy and says, wait a minute. Now, you told me X, Y, Z, A, B, C. And this guy looks over at him and says, well, you know, can we cut camera? Wow. Yeah, well, we can cut camera, sure. You know, and then it became, well, that's a bad question, man. That's a bad question. You shouldn't ask those kind of questions. And I'll never forget the look on Frank's face when this guy just turtled up on him and wouldn't deliver all this great information that he said that he had. And I think that's been the bigger problem of these movies and, honestly, of the entire investigation. You've got a lot of people who know a lot of things out there right now, but nobody's willing to help. Nobody's really willing to really step out there and provide the information that's necessary to move this case forward. I mean, I'm going record saying that.
I agree with you 100%. And what really struck me about your documentary, your series of documentaries, is that the amount of information that you provided and the lengths that you went through to ensure that you had all this documentation and evidence of, like, what happened regarding, you know, this event. And that really stood out to me because there's a ton of documentaries about the subject, about Tupac and his death, but yours, I would say, was probably the most in-depth that I've seen to date.
Thank you. Well, The Tupac story reminds me kind of Christmas time. Every Christmas we get together and we have Frosty the Snowman and Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer, and we have the same Christmas story, you know, the same movies that come out every year. And they all have their stories, and everybody knows those stories, and we tell those stories every year. And the Tupac story has kind of been like that from probably, I would say, the first 10 years that it was out there. There was just this kind of preconceived story about there was this guy that got into a fight with Tupac, and he got mad, and they beat him up, and he got mad, and he shot Tupac, and that was Orlando Anderson, and it was a gang thing, and there was this kind of pre-wired story that was just being told over and over again every year, and it really wasn't necessarily, there was no truth to it, but it was still a story that was being told over and over again, no different than, like I said, like Frosty the Snowman or Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer. I mean, do we really know that you know, Santa went to his sleigh and picked Rudolph? I don't know. That's what the song says. So maybe it's true, right? So again, you know, you had a lot of people that were just kind of by rote just retyping the same information over and over again. And it was really important to me because we got caught in a little bit of a crossfire by some LAPD cops, retired LAPD cops that, you know, accused me, RJ, of really just being a mouthpiece for Frank Alexander. That Frank had an agenda, and he didn't like certain people, and so he just used me, and I really just wasn't doing any due diligence. And unfortunately, that baffles me to this day, because there isn't much of anything that we couldn't put down. You take all three of these movies and you put them side by side, you put everything that we've got down there, and there's always a document or there's a witness behind what we're saying. We don't just try to, you know, we build a frame and then try to get a picture that'll fill the frame. You know,
exactly.
And that was the thing, and that, you know, it leads to making mistakes. You know, in the first Tupac assassination, Conspiracy or Revenge, we kind of drew a dotted line that might implicate Suge Knight in being directly responsible for the Tupac Shakur killing. And, you know, again, we don't in the movies, and it's a very difficult line to walk. But we try to maintain the line that allows the viewer to be the judge. We don't try to tell you, this is what we believe, you should believe this too. We try to say, for example, with a Sharitha Knight or with a Kevin Gaines or with a Suge Knight, you can look at these individuals and you can say, all right, you either believe they did it or you don't believe that they did it. But if you want to believe that they did it, here's a lot of really good reasons why you might believe that. Okay, here's a lot that would back you up. Here's some facts that might help you if that's what you want to believe. But we're not going to be the ones to say they did it. You know, the first assassination film, we got beat up a lot because, you know, Suge Knight was in the car with Tupac when they got killed.
Right.
And that was always very, very difficult factually to get around, just that fact that why would you arrange to have somebody killed and then put yourself in harm's way?
Mm-hmm.
There's a thousand reasons why. I mean, you know, Suge Knight shot himself in the leg, for heaven's sakes. I mean, you know, we know the guy's certainly not afraid to take one for the team if it means that he's getting something out of it. But and that's historically proven. And, you know, for me, you know, some of your best references are, you know, are classical references. You know, you had Julius Caesar, the story of Caesar where, you know, there was when there was an attempt on his life and he was killed, you know, that they circled him and stabbed him so many times, and the stabbing was so violent that the people that were actually stabbing him were actually stabbing each other because they couldn't get away from the stabbing. And so they ended up stabbing each other. So, you know, there's historical precedent to assassins themselves being hurt, you know, in the commission of the assassination. So just because
even John Wilkes Booth.
Yeah. Well, there you go. Exactly. You know, that's another great example. So it doesn't necessarily preclude you from being part of an assassination plot, but it was still something that we had a really difficult time getting around, just pragmatically speaking. We had a tough time. So we never quite went there far, but later after part two, and there was a good stretch of time between part two and part three, we finally got to the point where, you know, we started looking at, and there were some things, new evidence that had come in, and after every movie comes out, there's much more new evidence that rolls in. But we started to look at it and really start to think that maybe Suge was not the, you know, the suspect in this. Maybe he was actually a victim. Maybe he was an intended target for the killing that night. And, of course, that means that you're going to have to do a lot of mea culpas about your first two movies, because once you make a movie, it's out there. I mean, you can't roll it back. You can't recall it and say, hey, gee, I'm really sorry about what I said earlier.
yeah.
You can. Bob Zemeckis, the guy who made Back to the Future, you know, he said, pain is temporary, film is forever. So, you know, you can always put it out there, but once it's there, it sticks. It's there. We're going to have to live with whatever we say. And so when we look at those situations with Suge Knight, you know, we say, well, you know what, this is what we believed at the time. And every good investigator, a good detective, any good cop will tell you that it's okay to make mistakes and to say, you know what, we were going down this path and the math didn't add up. We were wrong. So let's go take a different path. Let's go look at something else. You know, it's really only the people that have painted themselves into a corner that fight so hard for this is the only way it's going to be and this is the only way it can ever be and everybody else is wrong but me. When you hear those kind of words or that kind of rhetoric, that comes from people that have painted themselves into a corner, that they've literally backed themselves in, and they don't have the room to say we were mistaken or facts have changed or this is new information that changes the look of things. You know, they don't allow themselves that latitude, and that gets them in trouble. But that's what allowed us to continue to keep going. As to the evidence that we collected, we were very fortunate. You know, Russ Poole was kind of the part where I started a lot of my research in 2006 when I got into doing this. And so getting to know Russell Poole's work and then, of course, getting to meet and getting to know Russell Poole himself as a man and then having him partner with me on working on the book, Tupac 187, and then, you know, the assassination battle for Compton after that. That really became a fulfillment of the need that I had to get as much information as I could. By that time, we had accessed all of Russell's police notes. We had all of the documentation that we had collected over the years, plus all the documentation that he had collected. So it was just a cornucopia of information. It's just, what do you do with it all?
Absolutely. Yeah, you're right. I mean, trying to figure out what to do with that amount of information is, you know, that is a process itself that, you know, takes time and patience and, you know, resources as well, because it's like you've got to, you know, once you gather all the information, it's like, what do you do with it then, you know? And so it's, in your professional opinion, your film does a really good job about, you know, basically laying out the breadcrumbs, so to speak, or your series of films. But in your professional opinion, do you feel as though the mystery of Tupac's real killer will ever be revealed?
I actually do. I'm one of the few people that do, because there's information that's still out there right now that has not been disqualified. There's information out there that has not been officially discounted. I know that recently a fellow by the name of Greg Kading, who has written a book called Murder Rap, who subscribes to completely opposite politics of what we do. He has his own theories about things. He released interviews with some of the people that we had directly, you know, I won't say indicted, but we definitely have pointed the finger in their direction as to allegations that were put up in a confession letter that was alleged to have been written by one of those individuals. So we, you know, he put those interviews up there, and we've had a chance to actually look at the interviews, and they are far from, what's the word I'm looking for? Far from freedom making. They're far from indictment free. You know, they do a lot to indict themselves. And so, you know, again, I still think that until these leads are conclusively proven wrong, they're still out there. And you never know what somebody else is going to call on the phone and talk about, you know, tomorrow. And it may be yet one more thing that verified that. So, no. Now, the problem is when we talk about, you know, will somebody come to justice? Well, that's our legal system. You know, knowing what happened and having an understanding of what happened and figuring out who did it and why is completely separate from getting the legal system in our United States to mount a prosecution and to indict a party for something and then to, you know, to prosecute them for that. I don't think that that'll happen. And, in fact, I know that it can't happen, even with the cast of suspects that we have now. One of the suspects that we have mentioned in Tupac assassination battle for Compton, he happens to match Yahu Fula, who was one of the witnesses. He was killed 2 weeks later, but he was one of the eyewitnesses to the shooting. He was in the car behind Tupac Shakur's vehicle when it was shot. He gave a description to the Las Vegas police of the driver of the suspect vehicle, and he gave a very good description of the driver of the suspect vehicle. And one of the people that are alleged to have written the confession letter actually pretty well matches the description given by the eyewitness. And when you look at that and you see that piece of information alone, you say, okay, well, now we have something that's really got to be overcome, because it can't be just coincidence that somebody claims to have been part of the assassination of Tupac Shakur, and then just so happens that a witness statement given to Las Vegas Metropolitan Police that they had kept under lock and key and was not publicly available to anybody, that this person might just match that description of the driver.
Right,
That's very, very tough odds to overcome. You could say, well, that description could be a lot of people. Well, sure, but how many people claim to have written a confession letter confessing to killing Tupac Shakur? You know, at the end of the day, how many people have done that? So, you know, and then match how many of those people match the description of the driver. And so I do think that we can. Now, the police can close a case. They can actually solve a case. And they can close a case as case closed other. And what that means is that means that because of the way our legal system is set up, the way our judicial system is built, a man has the opportunity to face his accusers. And that means that he can confront witnesses. If a man who's being accused of a crime cannot confront his witnesses, or those witnesses are not available to be confronted, there's no way that that man, under our current legal system anyway, can get a fair trial. So what the police can do is they can say, well, we figured out who did it and why, but there's no point in even trying to prosecute this case because Yahu Fula, for example, the fellow that gave the witness statement about the driver of the vehicle, the person that would be indicted does not have the opportunity to confront Yahu Fula because Yahu Fula is dead. Right. And that's the mastery of the people that were behind all this and all the deaths that occurred. They made sure, as the mob would say, that there are no witnesses. And it's not so much witnesses in the sense that they want to get rid of everybody that might have seen something, but they want to get rid of the people that were capable, that would be, that this guy would have to confront in terms of our legal system. So a police department can close a case, you know, we'll figure it out, but just because of the way our legal system is, this person would never get a fair trial, and because of that, we just will never get a prosecution on this fellow. Strangely enough, and this is what's interesting to me, is that the police have never done that. So if the police were so sure that Orlando Anderson had done it, and they were so sure that it was an East Coast, West Coast, Chris Blood thing, you know, whatever flavor of the week of that story you want to believe, because they change weekly.
Right, that's so true.
Whatever it is of that flavor of that story that wants to change or whose opinion of it is, if it was that clear and that obvious and that everybody and their brother knew it to be true, the police could close it. They could say, case closed, other, we're done. This case is closed. We just can't prosecute because, you know, but we do know who did it and we're going to put this to bed. And they have that choice. You know, now, when somebody says to me, well, you know, well, clearly, you know, they must know who did it. They must know, and they're just not doing anything about it. Look, Vegas police would like nothing more in the world to get this off of their back. I promise you that. LAPD does not want to hear about dead rappers. They don't want to hear about unsolved, you know, Tupac homicides. The Christopher Wallace family, you know, $500 million worth of music, you know, a potential $4 billion in damages to the city of Los Angeles. Believe me, if they could figure out a way to close this case and get this thing off of their backs, they would do it in a minute, okay? So the question remains, why is it still open? Why is it still open if they can close it?
That's the million-dollar question. I suppose that, you know, it just basically comes back around to, you know, some key point figures that, you know, basically don't want to be implicated in it. I mean, it's got a, you know, police corruption, of course, and, I mean, it's like somebody knows, people know, but they won't say.
Yeah, I think they can't. I think they can't close it. Yeah, I just think they can't close it. My opinion, anyway. I think they can't close it because if they tried to close it with an Orlando Anderson thing, it would just clearly, you know, scream low hanging fruit, and you know, and that's too easy. And I think they would get resistance from the public for doing something on that note. Surprisingly, less and less over the years, because it's like I said, like the Christmas story, you know, Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer. Here we go again, you know, fifth year in a row.
Right.
When you tell the story so many times, it just becomes dogma. And
right.
You know, and so with the Orlando Anderson thing, I think if they close it with Orlando Anderson, they might get some pushback, but they need something a little stronger than just what the word on the street is, because that's all they have. And so they're kind of compromised that way. Otherwise, the truth they would have to admit is, to pardon Al Gore's phrase, but a very inconvenient truth, that, you know, that they would have to admit that there were cops involved, and that Kevin Gaines from the Los Angeles Police Department was on special assignment in Las Vegas from 2 days prior to the Tupac Shakur shooting until 2 days after he died. I mean, you know, this guy's on special assignment on the LAPD, according to LAPD records. You know, what was his special assignment? You know, what was Sharifa Knight's boyfriend doing in Las Vegas during that whole time on this so-called special assignment? You know, what was
exactly
that about? So, you know, and that really begs people to answer questions that they just don't want to answer. The LAPD is not about to go into and explain what that special assignment was. You know, they're not going to talk about that. Because even if it had nothing to do with Tupac Shakur, it may have something to do with somebody who's actually still alive and still around today.
Exactly. Yes, you're so right.
There are public figures. Don't forget, there are public figures that are still inducing people into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, inducting people into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. There are still people rapping in Tupac's name and that are still around. And if the part of that special investigation where the LAPD might have been against somebody else, and not Tupac or not Death Row or maybe a member of Death Row who's still around, well, they probably don't want to admit to that because that might call for question from some people that have a lot of money. And that's
mm-hmm.
the last thing LAPD wants, is somebody else with a lot of money coming after them.
Exactly. And to paraphrase John Lennon, it's like everybody loves you when you're 6 feet under. And, you know, what's bigger
yeah.
than a dead rock star or a dead rap art, you know,
right.
rapper is, you know.
Yep,
it's buku bucks. So.
Yeah, absolutely. You're absolutely right.
These films that you've done, they're so in-depth. There's, you know, I don't claim to be a film buff or a critic or an expert, but just as a moviegoer and, you know, as a movie connoisseur, I can tell that you put your heart and your soul into these projects. What was the most enjoyable part of making each film for you as you know, as a filmmaker?
Well, finishing them, for one. That's always really getting it where you're done. My wife can echo that sentiment. You know, the day that you're done putting 12-13 hours a day, and you know your family doesn't know who you are. You come home and the kids say, "Who's that man that just walked in?" You know, when that kind of things happen. You know, you've been in editorial for too long, and documentaries are largely editorial pieces, much more than say a conventional feature film, because a scripted film is shot for the script and everybody knows what it's going to be. And even in editorial, you've got some latitude to the right or the left, but there's not a lot of, you know, you're still following the same script. You're still following the same storyline. A documentary can be a completely different animal because you understand what you're going after, but a lot of things can turn just on the value, because it is unscripted, the value of what you might get from somebody doing an interview. You know, some interview, you might interview somebody about Elvis, and he said, well, you know, when I was talking to Elvis right before he went to the toilet where he died, he said this. Well, nobody's ever heard that statement before. Nobody's ever even known that there was a guy that he talked to right before he went to the toilet. But now all of a sudden you're confronted with this piece of information, and it could fundamentally change the flow of your documentary because you can't deny that it exists. You can't deny that this fact actually exists. So editorial can be a monster on a documentary. And for that reason, you know, it's always a blessed event when they're done. So I joke about that, but it's true. Finishing a movie, actually getting it done, getting it off to the distributor, passing, you know, getting all your QC done and all that kind of stuff. That, I think that's probably the greatest joy. From a holistic point, man, first off, I've met so many amazing people. Tracy Robinson, Layla Steinberg, Gloria Cox, Adrian Gregory, you know, Shock G. The list just goes on and on and on of people that I've had the luxury to meet. You know, I should say the privilege to meet, to talk to. I've had them in my home for dinner. These people were very much right there and in the center of what was happening around this investigation. And to have these people at your house, to have these people eating with you, talking with you, enjoying the time that you have together, and even still, you know, getting on the phone and you still call these people and can still talk to these people. You know, it's an investigation to me, but it was their lives. It is their lives. And I think that the privilege that I had to meet these people, to understand more about Tupac, not secondhand from some police report or from some, you know, third-hand relative twice removed or some other cops or, you know, a newspaper article or a magazine article like a lot of movies have been based on. You know, I mean, I got to talk with everybody who was just close to Tupac. And so much of the information that we got was, I mean, that's what inspired the whole second movie. The second movie was really a journey on the human impact that somebody's death means. So Tracy Robinson, Layla Steinberg,
right,
Tupac's family. You know, the first movie was really a bullet point scenario about, you know, the hard hit facts about what happened that night and why and all that. But the second movie was really more of a look at the people that loved him. I mean, when somebody is gone from you, they depart, you know, that leaves a gap. Their death is felt. And we really, you know, wanted to emphasize that. And I got a lot of that from, like I said, just hanging out with the people that were there that were talking to them. So I would say that's probably the biggest holistic thing is just the quality of good people that I've had a chance to meet and interview. I have hanging on my wall one of my Tupac assassination movie posters from when the first one was released. We had a number of posters that we put out for the Atlanta Film Festival. We got the red carpet award for that. That was kind of exciting in 2009, I believe it was. No, 2008. And when we did that, I actually started a tradition of bringing my poster with me. I take it out of the frame, roll it up, and I take it with me when I go on an interview or I meet somebody that, you know, I was doing an interview with somebody that was close to Tupac. If they personally, physically touched Tupac, I wanted their signature. And so I have a poster that's littered with people's signatures all over it, with everybody that you know, Tupac physically touched. Like I said, not second cousins twice removed, not a newspaper reporter, not, you know, some cop talking to other cops. I'm talking about these are people that could have introduced me to Tupac to sit down and have dinner, okay? These are the people I wanted to sign my poster. And the number one signature on my poster, and everybody asked about it, is Afeni Shakur. And so when you get, you know, she knew the politics of Tupac's assassination. She and the family came out to the Spaghetti Junction Film Festival, which is the Atlanta Film Festival that we got the award for. The foundation came out. They came out with us to watch a screening of the movie. They showed their support. We introduced this to the foundation. They let us shoot our movie on the grounds of the Tupac Shakur Foundation. And on Tupac's birthday, I just happened to bring my poster that time. And Afeni was there, and I talked with Afeni for a little bit, and I asked her, would you mind signing my poster? Now, if you think for a minute that Afeni didn't agree with our politics, do you think for a minute any of those things would have happened? No, of course not.
Exactly. Yeah, Afeni would have voiced her disgust if,
yep,
you know, if she had a gripe with you.
Yeah, she'd have had the lawyers all over us, and, of course, we would have never been able to shoot at the foundation, at the Tupac Shakur Foundation. We'd have never had the family there. She would have told GLOW, you know, Gene, don't go to the show. You know, we don't agree with what they're doing. You know, the foundation has never been shy about expressing their displeasure with things. So, you know, I got over a long time ago people saying, well, the estate doesn't agree with what you're doing. The estate doesn't care. Bullshit. You know, I called BS on that. You know, I have a signature. I have a Feeney's autograph on my Tupac assassination poster. And that says everything that I need to know about the fact that we were at least doing the right things, that our hearts were in the right place. You know? I mean,
exactly.
Really. I mean, I've got no skin in this game. You know, Tupac wasn't my close friend. He was Frank's friend. He wasn't my close friend. I really don't have much in the way of, you know, some people say, oh, you're in it for the money. Well, you need to understand, documentaries don't make a killer. They're not, you know, if you break even, you're lucky.
Right.
You know, so they say, oh, you're in it for the money. The reality is that I've got, you know, no skin in this game. I've got no reason that I should decide that Orlando Anderson did it or that somebody else did it or that, you know, the man on the moon did it or Oprah did it. You know, I really don't have any skin in the game to, you know, have anything riding on offering an opinion one way or another about it or making a movie that expresses an opinion one way or another about it. You know, I do this for somebody I don't know, Michael Carlin, my director, co-director on Assassination Battle for Compton, you know, same thing. You know, we don't know these people. And I see a lot of people that have claimed to love Tupac and been family and friends and rappers that have made a lot of money off of Tupac. They claim they love Tupac and would induct him into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, but haven't spent a single dime on a reward for him. You know, that
really,
did nothing
really
to try to help. Yeah, it really does. I mean, you know, so you can throw rocks at me all day long and question my motives, but I say, you know what, wait a minute. I'm a complete stranger to this guy, and I'm taking rocks being thrown at me for what? For doing the work that somebody else doesn't want to do? I mean, you know,
right.
Go clean up your own mess, you know?
And so I
feel very strongly about the fact that our hearts are in the right place. Like you said, it's a labor of love. I mean, Frank Alexander's dead now, and he was a godfather to my oldest son. We had that kind of a close relationship. There wasn't a day that went by that Frank and I didn't talk every day. And we talked several times a day sometimes. And, you know, we just had that close relationship. Same thing with Russell Poole. Russell Poole stayed at my house for a period of time. You know, that we just had an awesome relationship with each other, and, you know, now those people are gone. They're dead. And that hurts me personally, and it makes me want to honor what they were looking to do, and that was try to get some closure, try to get some answers to this thing. And so how could you not, you know, how could you not do, you know, do them justice in putting out a haphazard documentary? So when we did part three, we just said, you know, we're going to bring the whole house down with this one.
Which, you know, I thought was, you know, was a fitting, you know, it was a fitting film, you know, that you did because it, you know, to me, just like you said, the gloves were off on that one. I mean, really all of them, but that one more so per se, just, I could tell that was your middle finger to everybody.
Well, yeah. I mean, you know, the problem is, yeah, well, you know, Martin Luther King said that, you know, we start to die the day that we become silent about things that matter. And you know, when you come out and you say, all right, you know, what am I trying to do with this last movie? I've got one thing left that I'd like to say about the matter. And, you know, I still posted the blog and I still answered fan questions, and we're putting out little videos here and there. But in terms of the big movies, the flagship movies, if you want to call them that, what do you want to say? If you're going to say a third one, you know, what is it that you want to say? What's your you know, thesis here? And I really wanted people to come away with a sense of two things. Number one, that I want you a little upset, because until the noise is gone, no matter what the other theory is, it's never going to get heard. It's never going to get, you know, brought to the front, because you could have the best theory in the world, and as long as everybody's still chanting Orlando Anderson and that propaganda machine is still running, you're never going to get a word in edgewise. So there's always that part, and that's frustrating. But the second thing about it is that, you know, regardless of that, there is a lot of information that's still out there, a lot of information that's good information that could be looked at, and it just isn't being done. And I think that's ultimately the most frustrating thing. I told people early on, even my sound engineer, when we were doing Final Mixdown, I said, what'd you think of it? He says, well, I'm kind of frustrated with it. And I said, why? And he says, because you didn't point the finger and say, who did it? You didn't come out and solve that puzzle. Who did it? And I said, then,
okay.
Well, I said, but then you get it. Then you get the movie. You get it.
Right. There's, I mean, to me,
you know, you get it.
Yeah. To me, it was like you were clearly trying to draw. You know, you were trying to let people use their own mind to kind of to see, because when you, here's the thing, when you tell people the truth, you know, it's up to them whether they receive it or not, you know. And so you presented the truth. And, you know, the only thing that, you know, we can do as a viewer is just basically take the truth that you've given us, that you've shown us, and then just, you know, draw our own conclusions. Because, I mean, people essentially will draw their own conclusions anyway. But,
right.
I mean, it's all there. I mean,
you got to do your homework. Story. I mean, that's. Yeah, do your homework. I mean, don't take my word for it. Do your homework. What if we say this is something exists, go do that. I mean, I get mad at the other camp with the other politics because they'll make some outrageous statement and say XYZ ABC, and well, where is the documentation to prove that? Where are you proving this? You say something happened. Show me something. You know, show me a, you know, oh, this guy said this and I was this, that. Okay, well, fine. Show me the doc. That's why we kind of came up with the saying, forget the talk, show the doc. You know, where is your proof that any of this, you know, that you're claiming, you know, happened? You know, can you corroborate it? And that's why we started tearing up the whole chain snatch story, was because the further down you got into it, the worse it got and the sillier it got, and what, you know, how much nonsense it really was. And at the end of the day, Lakewood Mall, there was just a Tim Brennan, the cop that's in the movie that we talk a lot about, he just put out a book last week. And I had a chance to read the book, and in the book, he mentions a few very interesting things. And one of the things that he mentions is that there's actually a whole other chapter to the chain snatch. And without getting your listeners too bogged down in the details of the movie, we talk a lot about a story called the chain snatch story, which is supposed to be the whole motive that Orlando Anderson killed Tupac Shakur.
Right, which is a load of baloney.
Well, I mean, you know, you take it at face value, you take it what it is. Tim Brennan actually wrote in his book, and it was just published, he wrote in his book that actually, well, to tell you the truth, the chain really never got snatched. He claims that the Lakewood Mall fight happened, but that the guy dropped his chain and he picked it back up again. Okay, the Trayvon Lane never actually lost his chain, and that it never got into his possession. So wait a minute. So then how do you justify somebody getting killed over a stolen chain? Okay, for something to be stolen, usually you have to have it, you know, away from your possession. You don't have it anymore, right? Because how can you steal something and still maintain control of it? It doesn't make any sense. So but now Tim Brennan goes, well, you know, I was talking with Trayvon Lane. He says that, well, maybe that chain never really did get stolen. Sure, there was a fight at the Foot Locker, which, by the way, has never been proven. Well, there was a fight at the Foot Locker, but that chain was really never snatched. It was actually, he dropped it. and now he's picking it back up again. Well, oh my God, there's a huge difference between getting something stolen violently from you and you dropping it. You know, but I guess it doesn't work too well in a murder narrative if you say that the motivation for somebody to want to kill somebody else was that somebody was stupid and dropped their chain.
Right. It adds to the controversy if you doctor it up a little bit.
Right. And, you know, and it never ends. And that's why it becomes funnier to me because, as in the movies, we pull out all these things and we make these statements. You know, here it is. Here comes another piece of information, another, you know, in this case, a book from Tim Brennan, who in the movie's opinion has some kind of questionable credibility in terms of what he's put out there. You know, and now he's saying, well, you know what, we're going to tell the story a little different way this time. So, you know, it just to me, I keep telling him, well, just keep telling your story. We'll go work this path over here, which is completely away from all that nonsense. We'll just go work over here in our own yard. And, you know, dig up the leads that we want to dig up. So that's, you know, and the work continues. I mean, we're still, you know, pumping out. I mean, we're still, when leads come in and people have something to say, you know, we're putting out some information. We're getting ready to drop probably in the next week. We're getting ready to drop a bomb on everybody who thinks that the confession letter is nonsense, that thinks that one of the theories that we put out in the movie doesn't hold water, doesn't hold weight. We're about to drop a bomb, Blav, and drop a bomb on everybody on that one. So, you know, we're excited about that because, again, you know, first off, if you're hammering on the confession letter, you watch Tupac Assassination, we'd probably talk about the confession letter for 10 minutes. The movie's 2.5 hours long. You really can't say we spent a lot of time talking about it. But what we talk about is that there is an alternative theory that's out there, and it just will never get the traction that it deserves because there's noise on the Orlando Anderson thing that's making too much noise. The official narrative, the volume's turned up so high you can't hear anything else. But we only talk about it for 10 minutes. But since we are talking about it, there are people like to think that the theory is completely bat crap, but you still go back to it. You say, okay, well, why do you say that? Okay, you can't just out of hand say, oh, this is funny because so-and-so would never be, you know, he wrote Brenda's Got a Baby. The allegation that Brenda's Got a Baby wasn't written by Tupac is ridiculous.
Yeah, it really is.
But, you know, here's the thing about it. You can say that the allegation that, you know, Brenda's Got a Baby was stolen, Little Half-Dead thought that Brenda's Got a Baby was his and that Tupac Shakur stole it. Well, the challenge there is that the two facts do not have to be contradicting facts. On the one hand, Little Half-Dead could think that Tupac stole his stuff. It doesn't mean that Tupac did. It doesn't mean that Tupac really didn't write Brenda's Got a Baby, and he no doubt probably did write Brenda's Got a Baby. But if Lil Half-Dead feels like he got ripped off, I mean, wars have been started worldwide over people's misconceptions that they've been wronged somehow, okay? When you look back at it historically, you go, well, wait a minute. You know, they really weren't wronged. You know, they made a mistake. They thought they were wrong, but they weren't, and they started the whole war because they wrongfully thought they had been, you know, screwed somehow. Well,
absolutely.
You go back and you bring down the letter, that's kind of the same thing you got going there. You have a lot of people that put the letter down for all the wrong reasons. So now what we said is, okay, if you want to talk about the letter, now let's talk about the letter. And that'll be our next video. That's what we'll put out. And we're not obviously selling that. That's going to go up online on YouTube.
Okay. And that leads me to my next question. Where can our listening audience find out more about you and keep abreast of the current and the upcoming, updates that you have regarding, the Tupac assassination?
Cool. Well, there's a couple of places. The first thing is the Tupac Assassination Battle for Compton Facebook page is always a great place to go and see. I'm on there. I mean, I'm posting things just constantly on that page. Even if it's an article that's not necessarily favorable to us, if I think it is fair and somebody's got an alternative point of view, I'll put it out there. I'll put it up on there. And, you know, it's Facebook is TA3, Battle for Compton. So if you go to Facebook, you know, .com, and you put in TA3, Battle for Compton, all one word, you'll pop up our Facebook page, and that's where we actually do most of our dialoguing with members and interview articles and that. The other place is there's a YouTube channel called the J-Mix channel. It's J-M-I-X, J-Mix channel, and a lot of the videos that we do in collaboration with one of our producers on the show, Jesse Surratt, he runs a channel called the J-Mix channel. A lot of the videos when it comes to YouTube videos that we do, we put them all out through his channel. He's been a huge supporter. That's how I got to know him to begin with. He does a lot of interviews with rap people, a lot of people that I just couldn't get to in an average day, you know, and some people that even we did an interview and we just didn't use it in the movie. You know, we had 8 hours worth of material in this movie. You know, we had to cut it down to 2.5. So, you know, stuff that we put out, that's the best place you can go to find new information, new videos, new stuff that we're doing. And then, of course, the movie itself is available on Amazon Prime, Amazon.com. I've heard it's supposed to be on iTunes. iTunes is a drag in their butt getting it put out because there was a technical problem with our closed captioning. You know, that those things happen. So it'll be out soon. And again, those are the best places you can see it. Even YouTube carries it. I think you can rent the movie or download it for $3.99. We're a cheap date, easy to look at if you want to see the movie. It's easy to get. And, you know, I encourage people to, you know, watch it and then make a decision for yourself. But do your homework. Don't just take what we have to say for granted. Just go do your homework. If the subject matter interests you, or if there's something you think is strange, there's a helicopter transaction floating around somewhere in Compton, you know, hit us up. Hey, I want to see those city council minutes where they talk about the helicopter. Okay, we'll send them to you. No problem. You know, no problem. We have no problem showing you any of the thousands of pages of material that we have if you really want to know. But I'd encourage people to not just make summary judgments based on what they've heard from a news reporter or from a from an ex-cop or from a newspaper writer who thought that they were covering the story, you know, 20 years ago. You know, do your homework. Get out there and ask us for the information. We're happy to share it.
Absolutely. And, Richard, my last question is there's a biopic called Tupac, All Eyes on Me, that's set to be released later this year. It's a feature film. What are your thoughts on it? Do you feel like this film obviously will be for more, I guess, entertainment purposes. But do you think that they will touch on any of, the possible motives or anything related to Tupac's death?
Well, unfortunately, I haven't seen as much of it as I would like to. I've seen bits and pieces from it, and I probably know more than any big fan may have seen. I know from talking to some of the people involved with the production of the movie, though, that, you know, they really don't get into it. I mean, the Orlando Anderson fight's there. The factual incidents that happened that evening are there. Obviously, they're going to be portrayed artistically. I'll just put double quotes around that. There's going to be a certain slant to the way the story is told. And I know that they, you know, they show the shooting itself going down. But from what I understand, that's the end of the story, and they don't really go into anything more than that. I don't think that they really offer an opinion, and it's very wise when you're trying to do a major release that millions of people want to watch. I don't think you want to be offering opinions on why you think things happen a certain way. I think you just mentioned that they do. So I think that they'll present it a little bit, but yeah, I just look at this movie as kind of a Tupac's greatest hits album. It's for people that have never don't know who the guy is, don't really think about his story. I think it's going to be a great story. Is it the story that may be the truth? Yeah, I don't know. Maybe not. I worked on a documentary called Tupac the Early Years with Adrian Gregory, who was Tupac's manager. And there's some information that is still, again, you know, we're talking about the Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer story. You know, what public knows about Tupac and what the truth are, you know, those are two different things. So if the filmmakers decide they want to, you know, rewrite Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer and they want to put that back out again, South by has to pay royalties to Rudolph, whoever wrote Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer. I've mentioned it 50 times now. If they want to put that out there and they want to tell the story that everybody that's been around that long knows and just sing along if you know the words, then that's the kind of movie you're going to get. Maybe they'll be daring and put a few things out that maybe somebody didn't know, that might help somebody that's interested in trying to figure out what happened. No, I just don't think it's going to be that way. I think they're looking, they want to sell some records. Universal is in charge of it. They hold the estate, the catalog, the Tupac Shakur music catalog. They want to sell some movies. They want to sell some record albums. And why the hell not? You know, this is right. This is the USA where we're all, you know, capitalists and, you know, commercial artists. And that's, you know, that's what we do. You know, and I hope it's going to be good. I hope it'll be entertaining. I will go and see it. I know I will. You know, I will take my wife on our Friday date night, and that's what, probably what we'll see that weekend. And I hope that we enjoy it. It's kind of a strange thing. You can imagine me going to the movie, watching the biopic. I'm watching it almost like an editor would watch a movie where you're picking everything apart. I'll try to not do that, but at the same time, you know, I hope it's enjoyable. I'm looking forward to it. I wish them well. I hope they are very successful in the movie, in the production of the movie and putting it out there and all that. There's a lot of people that have been involved in it that I know personally. There's another great movie, though. The movie I'm actually more interested in than even the biopic is a movie coming out in, I think it's November, I think it's coming out with Johnny Depp called Labyrinth. And that's actually the story of Russell Poole, the detective that broke this case. That was the Christopher Wallace thing. And Russell Poole, my partner, you know, he's being played by Johnny Depp in a major motion picture that's going to be released in November.
That's so cool. I had no idea about that film. Wow.
Yeah, just check it out. When you can jump online and check it out, you'll start to see things about it. I mean, it got a little bit of noise when it first started production. And then when it goes into editorial, things kind of fall into the news black hole for a while, and then it'll suddenly pop up. It's supposed to be making the film festivals starting in October. I think it premieres in China in October, which is fortunate for us because we just signed our book deal over in China. So it's very exciting. We have a Tupac 187, and the other books are out in China now, so that's very exciting for us. But, yeah, Labyrinth is going to be, you know, that's Russ Poole's story. That's the story of how this whole investigation started and where Michael and I picked up the ball with Russell years later doing it. It's not Michael's and my story by a long shot, but I'm very honored that the movie is going to talk about the guy who worked with us and what we believe is solving this thing. So, you know, it's very exciting. Labyrinth is the name of the movie with Johnny Depp.
I'm definitely going to check that out.
Yeah.
Well, Richard, I want to thank you so much for taking time out of your busy schedule to do this interview with me. Amazing talking to you. I'm all out of questions, but I wanted to open the floor to you if there's anything you'd like to say to our listening audience.
Well, you know, here's the thing. The one thing I could get out to your audience, and I said it earlier, but I'll just say it again. Don't take my word for it. I'm nobody, okay? Greg Keating is a nobody. Kathy Scott is a nobody. Anybody who puts a Tupac documentary out, they're nobody. You are the person that makes the decision on what you believe, but I want you to own what you believe. Don't just tell me that we're out, you know, that we make no sense and that we're out for chicken feed. Tell me why you don't think I make any sense. Tell me why you disagree with something that I have to say, because I've got documents here. I'm not afraid to be wrong. I was wrong about Suge Knight. I changed my opinion about Suge Knight 100%. Doesn't mean I can't change my opinion. But when you come at me or anybody else, and this is what I would encourage all fans and people that are watching any of these documentaries, is get out your pencil and paper. Make some notes. Do a couple of fact checks on it. Make sure that the people that you're listening to know what the hell they're talking about. Because there's a lot of bad information out there, and if you just believe it because this person says that they were a homicide investigator or a lead investigator on a drug task force, or that these guys said they solved the case, oh, that must mean it's true. If that's the way you're going to believe, then, you know, I feel sad for people. Do your research. Do your homework. The best way you're going to enjoy a documentary is to know that the people that gave you this information are reliable. That's the big thing I want to pass to the Tupac fans. And the other thing is a sincere thank you from the bottom of my heart. You all I've been doing this now 10 years. This would be Tupac Assassination Conspiracy or Revenge celebrates its 10th anniversary, October of this year. We are putting out, as you would expect, a 10th anniversary edition of Tupac Assassination Conspiracy.
Wow.
Working on that right now. So you got the scoop on that. That is coming out. We are doing that. It may or may not include an up-res to Blu-ray. Assassination 3, Battle for Compton is on Blu-ray. It's one of the few Tupac titles that are actually on Blu-ray, that you can get on Blu-ray. So, it's, you know, it was exciting. We wanted to do that. You know, HD material with Tupac is kind of a hard thing to pull off because the HD wasn't around when Tupac was around. So
right.
It's kind of a hard thing to pull off. But we do that, and we're trying to see if we can push the 10th anniversary of Assassination 1. We'll see if we can push that into a Blu-ray format. We'll see if we can do that for people that like Blu-rays. But it's going to be out there, and it's going to be available, and we're excited about that. But thank you to the fans, to the people that have really, you know, wanted the truth out there, that wanted to seek the truth out there, you know, for supporting us, for supporting our work. It's not a day that goes by that we don't get attaboys from people or people chiming onto the Facebook page telling us we're doing the right thing. But I literally couldn't have done this without the fans, without their support, without occasionally when you have a down day and somebody's beating up on you, having some fan pop their head up and say, man, I just want to let you know, I saw that Blu-ray and you just off the chain. You were so good and your stuff was so on point. You know, that just makes your whole day. It does. You're just never quite that far removed from something that it doesn't make your day personally. So you can be having a just crappy day and somebody, you know, one person posts up how much they enjoyed the movie and boom, your day just goes from bad to good. So thank you to the fans. Really appreciate it. Keep up the hard work. Keep searching for the truth. We're definitely not done. We're still talking. There's definitely dialogue to be had, and we're going to be right in the middle of it.
Awesome. We look forward to it, Richard. We look forward to it.
Thank you again for having me, man. This has been a ball. We'll chop it up again, come up with some more questions. And, in fact, you know, something I've been wanting to do for some time is if you get some fans and you get some listeners that have questions and they send you emails with questions, put the list of questions together. Get me back on the phone and let's answer those questions.
Absolutely.
Absolutely.
We will do it. We will do it. Awesome. Well, thank you so much, Richard. I really appreciate it.
No problem, man. You have a great rest of your day.
All right, you as well.
All right, take care.
Take care. Guys, that was filmmaker Richard Baum. You can check out his newest film, Tupac Assassination, Battle for Compton. We'll put a link to that film in the body of this post. If you're listening to us on SoundCloud, go ahead and hit the subscribe button. We're also available on your iOS device. If you've got an Apple product of any kind, you can listen to us by downloading the Stitcher Smart Radio app. It's available for free in the iOS store. Download the app, search for our show name, Redefine It, Counterculture. You'll hear this interview with Richard. We're also available for Android users. If you've got an Android phone, you can search for us in the Google Play Store. Search Google Play Music. Search for our show name. You'll be able to hear this interview with Richard. We're available at home. If you've got a Roku player or a Roku Smart TV, you can listen to us right in the comfort of your own home. We have over 200-plus hours of original content, programming, and interviews, all free of charge. Just go to the Roku Channel Store, search for our name, download the app. Once you download the app, you'll be able to begin streaming all those great, great hours of content, all free of charge. Lastly, we're available in your automobile. If you've got Apple CarPlay or any of the like, you can listen to us by downloading the TuneIn app to your car. And once you download that app, search for our show name, Redefine It in Counterculture.
Monster Energy, welcome to Rockville Return to Metropolitan Park, April 29th and 30th, with Def Leppard and Soundgarden. With The Perfect Circle, The Offspring, Mastodon, Chevelle, Papa Roach, Cedar, 3 Days Grace, Alter Bridge, The Pretty Reckless, and more. Welcome to Rockville. 2 days, over 40 bands, on 3 stages. Tickets are on sale now. Head over to WelcomeToRockvilleFestival.com for all tickets and more.